You know, Theresa May would always say Brexit means Brexit, but...
But what is Brexit?
What is Brexit?
Brexit? Brexit means what you want it to mean.
Hello and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Ferran Cecilia and I'm joined by my co-host Megan Rutkay and Zachary Wheeler. Today we will be discussing Brexit, Britain's planned exit from the European Union. What exactly is Brexit? Where is the process at now? What exactly is a Brexit deal? And what are the ramifications of Brexit on Europe and the world?
To help us answer these questions, today on the podcast we are joined by Professor Katie Hindmarch-Watson. Professor Hindmarch-Watson is an assistant professor in the history department at Johns Hopkins University. She is a cultural historian of Britain and the British Empire, and she is currently working on a project called Dispatches from the Underground, Telecommunications Workers and the Making of an Information Capital, 1870 to 1916. Professor Hindmarch-Watson, thank you for joining us today.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, cool. How about we get started? So, Professor, could you maybe just give us an overview? What exactly is Brexit? What do we mean by that? Where did it start?
Brexit is what we call first a referendum and then a decision by the British public to sever ties with the European Union. One of the problems, though, is that what specific ties were going to be severed and what particular form Brexit would take was never really sorted out before the vote. And so the easiest way to explain the last 3 years is the quandaries exposed by what exactly Brexit means. And we can certainly talk about that.
Right. So why then do Brexit supporters want to leave the European Union? Like, what is the impetus behind their belief?
There are a number of different constituencies who have very different feelings about the European Union. So I'm going to talk about the sort of overtly, those who identify overtly with this project of leaving the European Union. And it mostly boils down to this idea of sovereignty. What the European Union does is it creates a sort of shared leadership bubble around the issue of the movement of people, of money, of goods, and of the justice system. So you have the European Court of Justice. And those who wanted to leave the European Union felt that British control, British power, British sovereignty was threatened by being part of this European Union project. Now, there are different degrees to which people felt that they could leave the European Union. One of the most fascinating things is even what we call the Euroskeptics. And there's been a Euroskeptic movement in Britain since really the 90s. And that's when the Maastricht Treaty came into being. And that's the set of documents that came up with the modern idea of the European Union. And you have Euroskeptics who wanted to stay in, the customs union, but get out of the single market. Or they wanted to have increased distance from the European Union. And then there was those who wanted to leave it altogether. I'll happily explain what the customs union and the single market is as we go along. For a lot of people, it actually doesn't boil down to economic pragmatism. It boils down to an idea that Britain should not be one among equals within Europe, that Britain is special, that Britain needs to retain complete control over all aspects of its economic, social, immigration, and political life. And now there are various different camps within this larger picture of Leave voters. A lot of people have argued that when the referendum happened in 2016, a lot of people were voting for all kinds of things that had very little to do with the European Union. And I'm again, happy to talk a little bit more about the backstory leading up to this referendum. What's interesting now is that for the first time in a long time, there's a very active and politicized Remain camp within British politics. And now that Britain is going to have to take part in the European elections, it's going to be very interesting to see how that Remain momentum builds up now that Brexit has been delayed until this Halloween, until October 31st of this year.
2019,
yes.
So, okay, I know I recently attended a seminar of Professor Hindmarch-Watson, and she, you presented a picture of a bus with a... I'm wondering if you could explain the picture of the bus, and maybe we'll post that in our social media.
Well, this is a good example of sort of the cultural... What sticks in the minds of a lot of people. So during the referendum campaign, the Leave campaign, one of the things the Leave campaign did is they had this bus and they painted, there's an amount of money that goes to the European Union every month. And they said, we could take, the bus basically said, this money is going to the European Union, we can put it straight into our healthcare system. At a time when, again, in the buildup to the 2016 referendum, there had been a series of austerity measures, cutting funding to social services and the healthcare system. And so the Leavers presented this argument that once we were out of the European Union as Britons, we could then take all that money we gave to the EU and just stick it into our healthcare system. And this, A, the number was misleading. That wasn't, the, you know, there was, it was a very surface level reading of that amount of money, because whatever was, while that initial amount would go into the European per month, you would get a huge amount of subsidies back. And also, and a key Leaver in chief, Nigel Farage, admitted shortly after the referendum that money would not be diverted en masse into the healthcare system. It just doesn't work that way. But the Leave bus, and yes, there's a picture of it in the background, dear listeners, it became something that became a touchstone. It became much discussed. It's something that was culturally resonant, and people remembered it. And a number of people talked about, well, you know, the bus, you know, and this money for the NHS. That became a talking point for the Leave vote that proved really popular. After the referendum, it became a kind of symbol of the backdealing and misinformation that the Leave campaign dabbled in. And also it should be noted that there have been fines divvied out to certain organizations within the Leave campaign. There's still some unanswered questions about where the money for the Leave campaign went. But rather like with some of the current quandaries in American politics, there is not a huge amount of political energy right now to sort of chase down those leads.
I guess, I mean, one thing I'm sorry to divert from the questions, but I guess, like, do you feel like the people who were really pushing the exit campaign, were they selling snake oil? Like, were they intentionally deceiving voters? Mm. Or do you think it was just, you know, lost in this, you know, they have these grand ideas of, you know, Britain being alone and prospering without the European Union?
I think the Leave campaign tapped in very effectively to some fears and cultural anxieties. I mean, the sad thing is the most Googled term after the morning after everyone woke up after the referendum was, what is the European Union? One of the things that the Leave campaign also effectively fanned the flames of was fears of immigration. And the idea that outside of Europe, Britain would have control to turn away immigrants from particularly Eastern Europe. That was a sort of target group. But also, and this is another important sort of context to the Brexit vote, 2015 was when the Syrian refugee crisis exploded. And you had European Union member countries, particularly Germany, welcome in huge numbers of Syrian immigrants. Now, other European Union member countries, including Hungary, were much more reticent. And this is another thing about the European Union. There are, within this union, it is not a lockstep body of laws, that there are negotiations between individual countries, particularly in how many non-EU citizens are allowed in. But one of the things that the EU does guarantee is the free movement of people within the bloc, within the group. So in Britain, for example, there's a lot of Eastern Europeans, people from the former Soviet bloc, that when these countries were welcomed to the European Union in the early 2000s, they went to work in the more affluent parts of Europe and Western Europe. And there was resentment within the UK about this sort of influx of Eastern European workers who often worked in very low-wage jobs and in the service economy. Again, with the pressures on austerity and the cuts to social services since 2012, that was easy to fan these flames, that the European Union is somehow a kind of a project of undermining British workers. And on top of that, there were these rumors that Turkey was going to get into the European Union. And the Brexiteers also fanned the flames of that. And that's one aspect in which, can we say they were being deceitful, or can they say that they were pushing a kind of xenophobic button that did resonate with a lot of people?
Right. And so we have these cultural anxieties that stem from immigration and possibly Turkey joining the European Union. Mm-hmm. But would you say that there's also some historical things at root here? Because yes. I know that Britain has a deep history of being of like the offshore balance, never liking to be involved in Europe unless they absolutely have to. Right?
Yes, the sceptered island, the island nation, the Britain stood alone during World War II to save Europe. It's interesting. I think that one of the things and one of the legacies of the British Empire is, again, an idea of a kind of British exceptionalism that can be tapped. Now, it's really vague, and I have to say, a lot of people who voted for Brexit weren't thinking in terms of Empire 2.0, you know, free from the confines of Europe. We will bring back, you know, a mighty British world that we will be in some ways able to dictate the terms of in terms of glorious trade agreements and all that. But within the Brexit intelligentsia, within certain confines of the Conservative Party, there were those, many of whom actually grew up as the children of imperial officials, who did see within Brexit the seeds of this kind of renaissance of a kind of British power. There's also a libertarian streak within the Brexiteers that wanted to break away from the labor and environmental regulations that the European Union imposes in order to kind of create a sort of a new free trade zone. They talked about the Singapore of the North Seas, which would involve radically changing wage structures in the British economy from the ground up. And it has to be said that the vast majority of people who had economic anxieties this was not their vision, a kind of new libertarian, you know, wages race to the bottom kind of view of the future. But this is part of the constellation of pro-Brexit voices and ideas. Mm. But for a lot of people, the Brexit vote was also a kind of screw you to the current government. The conservative leader who called the election to kind of sort out a long-standing beef within the British Conservative Party, the Tories. And that's why David Cameron said, okay, well, we'll have this election. And he actually said it, and it was legislated as advisory. In other words, not legally binding. But then he stated that the nation will honor the results of this referendum. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people who voted leave, it was a vote against the status quo. It was a vote because the government was campaigning to remain, but in a kind of lukewarm way. And so there was a bit of a... It was a moment of anxiety and resentment, and Brexit became a kind of we're going to shake stuff up mm-hmm. kind of vote, which again, we know a certain variant of in this country.
I was about to say I'd never heard one of those before.
Yes, I mean, and many people have noted that Brexit, Trump's election, and also election of a lot of reactionary populists all over the place at the moment. There seems to be something linking all of this, and it's not Putin pulling the strings. That's a whole other podcast. But, you know, there seems to be, with growing inequity and increased dissatisfaction with sitting governments, the political order, there seems to be a vogue at the moment for right-wing strongmen or reactionary politics or a kind of transactional or a mode towards the more transactional, insular, xenophobic mode of contemporary politics. And so when we talk about the sort of concerns about liberal democracy, the Brexit vote gets slotted in there. Now, that being said, if you are a Brexiteer, you might say that the Brexit vote was a stance for British liberal democracy. Right. And I will say that and let's just be very clear here, I am very much on Team Remain. So this is where my bias will go, and I completely acknowledge that, but I'll try and give the Brexiteers a fair shake.
Right. Well, thank you, Professor.
Yeah, thank you. And so we sort of talked about sort of the fears that people have and that sort of vogue towards insular mode of government. Would you mind talking about some of the institutions, if there were any, that people sort of, you know, channeled their fears towards? You mentioned the common market and a few others, and sort of how those work and what the discontent is there.
Well, for a long time now, and this is not just in Britain, but places like Italy and France, everyone can complain about those bureaucrats in Brussels, you know, and there's this idea that's being perpetuated that there's a bunch of unelected technocrats making these really important decisions about all of the economies within the European Union. it's always easy to hate bureaucrats. It's very easy. It's a kind of a classic target. And then again, this goes down to issues of sovereignty. And one of the things that is important to mention is that there has been a European Parliament for quite a while now. And actually in continental Europe, there's actually a lot of buy-in and a lot of people participate in European Union elections. In Britain, it's been good if over 40% of the population has participated in these elections. And so in the British case, it's usually around 37% of the population actually vote for their member of the European Parliament, their MEP. And that lack of interest is also what's allowed the fringe anti-EU parties like UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, led by Nigel Farage, to gain power. Nigel Farage, leader of the Leave movement, he has never sat as an MP in the Houses of Parliament, but he has been a longstanding member of the European Parliament. And him and a cadre of other right-wing parties are trying to destroy the European Union from within, right? And they've long been doing this. And again, Brexit was a major achievement for Nigel Farage. He resigned shortly after the victory. Now he's reemerged and started his own party called the Brexit Party, which will sit for elections in the next European elections. Because Britain, as a part of their extension deal, has to participate in the next round of European elections.
Cool. Professor, could you maybe talk to us a little bit about, we hear a lot about this terminology, a Brexit deal. What exactly is a Brexit deal, and what are kind of the main, what are the problems that are making it so it's been hard to reach a deal?
One of the problems with having 40 years of economic integration with the European Union and modern shifts with supply chains and what do they call it, up to the moment, meeting your up to the moment supply needs. I'm forgetting there's a specific word for that, which I'm blanking on. You have created a clearly and highly integrated system of the movement, again, of goods. You have the complete integration of agricultural systems. You have a number of ways in which pulling out of that arrangement is going to be complicated. So the two main things, and I mentioned these people, the two main things, economically speaking, that the European Union does or manifests is the single market. So if you're a member of the European Union, there are no tariffs or trade boundaries between, so France, Britain, Germany. It's a completely integrated economic system. There are no customs checks. And there's also, so that's the single market. And then you have what's called the customs union. And so what that means is the European Union as a whole negotiates what tariffs and what deals they will do with other countries. So for example, Canada has an agreement with the EU, not with Britain particularly, but so as a member country of the European Union, and the idea is to give leverage. The idea is to create power as everyone coming together to kind of get favorable tariff deals that benefit EU members when they're negotiating with other countries, including the United States, China, et cetera. I mean, the whole point of the European Union, when it first started as a European economic community, was to stop war happening ever again in the continent of Europe. Initially, it was to make the German and French economy so integrated that it would be mutually destructive to engage in any kind of conflict. And this is, of course, talking about West Germany when the European economic community is getting started up. And so it spread and spread and spread. But a lot of countries had buy-in. There was a huge, there were huge advantages to be made. Now, getting back to your question, what deal would provide the economic advantages that Britain currently enjoys outside of the European Union? And that's why no one can agree on anything, because by every economic forecast, Britain will end up worse, even with a soft Brexit. So say Britain stays in the customs union, or the single market, they'd lose their seat in negotiating and lose their voice and lose their electoral position within the European Union. So that seems sort of like you have to follow all the rules but less sovereignty. That's what Norway is essentially doing right now. So Norway voted in a very tight election to not join the European Union, but they are part of the larger project because of the economic advantages, but they don't have any actual say. So that's one model, but a lot of people don't like that. Then there's, okay, we're going to break from the customs union, we're going to break from this, and we want to be able to create our own trade deals. We want to be able to create our own deal with Canada, our own deal with whoever. And that's where it gets really tricky, because when you start changing the rules, you're going to need borders, you're going to need checks. So suddenly the port of Calais and the port of Dover, we have some serious backup issues that could result if suddenly, again, 40 years of integration, you out of nowhere have to create a whole bunch of infrastructure, check the border. But the most vexing thing of all, and what Brexit has kept coming up against, is the border in Ireland. Because there is a land border between the European Union and Great Britain, and it is on the island of Ireland. And the Republic of Ireland, which is the southern part of the island of Ireland, is hardcore EU. I think something like 87% of the Irish population is all in EU. Ireland, its modern incarnation, is very indebted, pleased, and embraces the European Union project. Right. Northern Ireland is very, well, the demographics are changing, but Northern Ireland remains very British identified. And you can't have different rules on goods and services and who comes in and who comes not without a border. That's why you have borders. But to create a hard border between Northern Ireland, part of Britain, Republic, is to poke a sleeping giant, which was over 30 years of violence between within Northern Ireland over this very question of British versus Irish identity. This period's called the Troubles. From 1969 to 1998, you had an ongoing conflict that was resolved in the Good Friday Agreement. And part of what made that agreement work was a softening of the relationship between the Republic and Northern Ireland, and creating more free movement and creating a more integrated system that meant that the peace project could tick along with having both Irish and British identified people in this territory in a way that would mitigate violence and try to encourage more crossover. And so far that peace project has been remarkably successful, but Brexit pokes at that, and it threatens that, and imposing a hard border back on the island of Ireland, not only would that do a lot of economic damage to both sides, there are people who are very concerned about what underlying tensions might come back to the surface. So that's one of the, but then right. What we call this, you might have heard of this, is the backstop. And I can explain what that is. Theresa May's deal, which is now being voted down 3 times, by the House of Commons, basically made a pledge to say to the European Union, we will actually keep the same regs and rules so that we don't need to create this hard border, and we'll figure it out later. Right. When the technology comes along or whatever. And so it was a way to kind of kick the can about this crisis. But in doing that, the deal, despite saying like we were going to be able to make bespoke trade deals, this and that, the other, it locks not only Northern Ireland, but all of the United Kingdom into essentially a
limbo.
A limbo, yeah, into the sort of customs union rules until such time when we can magically figure out this border problem. This is something that has really angered a number of Brexiteer MPs who see the Irish problem as relatively minor. It's also infuriated the hardcore British Nationalist Party, who is part of the Tory coalition right now. This is the Democratic Unionist Party. And they're a little bit complicated because you think that they might be kind of pro a maintaining of the peace, but they're most interested in staying as British as possible. And they see any kind of alignment or compromise with the Irish state as a slippery slope towards the creeping Irish nationalism. And so they're concerned that this backstop, it's so hard to explain the DUP. They're concerned that the backstop will effectively lead to Northern Ireland being treated differently than the rest of the UK. And they do not want that.
So we have talked about, you mentioned the Theresa May's deal, which has been voted down by Parliament 3 times. Mm-hmm. And I know that if they don't reach a deal, right, by the new extension,
by Halloween,
we're going to be faced with a hard Brexit.
Yes.
Could you explain a little bit what a hard Brexit would entail?
Oh, well, the funny thing is it's in a way it's sort of unimaginable because it's sort of there are no rules. There are no procedures in place to suddenly manage the flow of goods, money, services, people between the United Kingdom and the European Union. Some of the, you know, there's been various projections about sort of financial losses. There's been some movement within the financial service industry within Britain to move to, you know, move or plan to move their headquarters to places like Dublin or Frankfurt. Because of the concern about the supply flows. There's no hard Brexit means there's no laws. There's no, and so you kind of have to make everything up on the spot, but you also need, you will require all new border checks. You know, it's a smuggler's paradise if you suddenly, you know, in this, where there's no infrastructure whatsoever to suddenly manage a country who's supposed to have different trading rules and immigration rules and all that stuff. So it's a kind of what we just imagine is chaos. The first thing that comes to mind is food shortages. Again, there's a highly integrated agricultural system within the European Union, and there's lots of subsidies there. So like getting certain food to the UK would be a problem. Also, the subsidies that actually help British farmers would be cut off. And so there would be, again, this all of a sudden there'd have to be complete renegotiations within Britain about who's paying for what, who gets delegated what. You know, there's a lot of ways in which the European Union has dealt with these problems at a sort of at a larger level. And so in taking back control, there's a lot of, it's the boring little details of policy. But imagine if none of that exists. And it's sort of, it is. It's a little bit mind-blowing. Now, there's sort of plans to have like a managed no deal. There's this, that, and the other. But it's something that the business community really doesn't want. It's something that most Britons don't want. There is a rump of parliamentarians who actually think this is all a continuation of what they called during the referendum Project Fear, that this is all just scaremongering to keep us in the EU. Everything's going to be fine. Shut up. That's some of the reactions of the kind of no-deal Brexit. Like, and they're saying no deal is better than remaining. What matters to them most is sovereignty. But one of the interesting things is the business community in particular is getting more and more and more vociferous. And again, the Conservative Party is supposed to be the party of business. They're supposed to be the like center-right, you know, arbiters of essentially a pretty relatively deregulated financial and business sector. They're supposed to be the party that businesses can trust with their money and the Tories won't pass anti-business leg. And here we have them playing with something that would be economically catastrophic. And so that there's more and more, and there's that's a really important pressure group for the current government to listen to.
And it would also be geopolitically disastrous because we've been talking about, you know, how there's a certain element of like, yes, British Empire to this decision to leave Brexit, but Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain, and they have said that they will leave the UK if Brexit does happen. And also, there's the Northern Ireland question as well.
The Northern Ireland question, and it's great, exactly. We might see not just Britain leaving the EU, but the breakup of Britain. Scotland's political center has gradually shifted much further to the left than the political center in England. So there's already a lot of dissatisfaction and a lot of dissonance between Westminster and Holyrood. Holyrood is the devolved Scottish Parliament. Yes, one of the reasons why Scotland narrowly voted to not leave the UK back in 2015 was, again, like, hey, we're better together. We're part of Britain, and then Britain's part of the EU, and this is a better deal. Now, one of the things, though, is that could mitigate against that is, you know, having a border between Scotland and England, if England stays out of the EU and Scotland votes to come in, that would also cause a lot of frictions. Also, one of the things that makes Scotland arguably, you know, could potentially relatively wealthy is that there's a lot of oil, but oil prices can fluctuate. But I do think that there is, and again, there's a huge amount of momentum behind the Scottish National Party right now. The Labour Party, the sort of centre-left party in Britain, has really had problems in Scotland. And so there's a lot of energy momentum behind the Scottish Nationalists right now. One of the other things, though, to keep in mind is that within the European Union, there is a concern about stopping other small states from breaking away. I'm thinking Spain. So in order to prevent the Basque or the Catalan region from breaking off, the European Union might not want to encourage an independent Scotland being instantly ushered in as a member state. So there are other geopolitical consequences of this. But no, I do think that Brexit does raise this as a serious issue. And then, of course, the question of Northern Ireland. You know, maybe Brexit will be the one thing that will unite that Ireland. You know, who knows? But it does. It throws the United Kingdom into a bit of an existential crisis as well.
The very existence of
the... The very existence of the United Kingdom. Right. Yes. Those kingdoms that have been united for a while now. Yeah.
Wow. So we've talked about a lot of the difficulties of reaching a deal and, you know, the fact that thus far Britain has not been able to reach a deal. So what are the likelihoods of a second referendum, also known as the people's vote? And, you know, would that be an alternative to reaching a deal?
They have gone up. They have really gone up with this extension. Now, there is still, the extension was a kind of a bit of a fudge. Initially, it had been projected that the EU would offer all the way till December. Macron kind of put his feet in and said, no, you know, Britain needs to sort this out. So October 31st is actually not enough, or not a whole lot of time to actually create the whole lattice work of you need for a referendum. But what the second referendum folks or the people's vote folks want to do is create enough energy to create the momentum and then actualize a referendum and then go to the EU with an extension beyond October 31st. Because look, we have something changed. We're going to have another vote on this. So this extension, I mean, what this extension really does is also given everyone a kind of a, just like a bit of breathing space, because for the last 3 months, it has been insane. Like, there have been incredible parliamentary shenanigans. There have been these indicative votes. There has been, every morning I was waking up going, what on earth is going on? Yeah. And now we've basically just kicked the can down the road, and we could be in exactly the same position we are in on Halloween. But one of the things to watch is, yes, momentum behind the second referendum, the results of the European elections, and if there is a sort of remain momentum that's going to manifest in getting a lot of progressive as opposed to anti-EU parties in the EU Parliament. There's also something to watch is Theresa May's very fragile hold on the Conservative Party. Rebellions within the Conservative Party, more people defecting. There's this new political party, the Independent Group.
The Tick, yeah.
Yeah, they recently tried to change their name to Change UK, which was Cuck. And I think some of their interns pointed out that that's probably,
probably
a bad idea.
Idea.
They're like, you know, they're sweet. They're like, what do you mean? Well, I don't know what this means. Like, yeah. So anyway, they're not going to call themselves that anymore, I don't think. But there's going to be more defections. There's also going to be, there's another civil war brewing within the Labour Party, because Jeremy Corbyn has been a bit of a Lexiter. So there's a left wing. I've been sort of explaining more of the right wing argument about Brexit. There's a left wing argument that says the EU isn't supportive enough of workers' rights, isn't supportive enough that it's a neoliberal project. Of course the EU is a neoliberal project, but it's divided the Labour Party, but I mean, it's divided. The vast majority of members of the Labour Party are very, very pro-Remain. They see reform within the European Union as a solution to some of the issues that they have with it. But there are some hardcore Lexiteers, and Jeremy Corbyn has long been a Eurosceptic. And for him, he wants to, again, break off with what he sees as some of the two pro-business-friendly aspects of the EU and create a more robust socialist state outside of what he perceives as some of the laws of the EU that would inhibit a kind of mass renationalization of certain industries, for example. And again, there's a lot of debate about that. But within the Labour Party, there's growing momentum, and that's not to be confused with the group of Corbyn supporters that are called Momentum. But there's growing momentum within the European, or within the Labour Party, to kind of force Labour to really officially come out and say, we are going to work towards this people's vote. Because they've paid lip service towards it, but there's still a lot of waffling going on.
Right. Like, when I was looking at the news back in 2016, and, you know, I think the results were 52 to 48.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately, and for the snap elections in 2017, I think that the Labour Party announced Jeremy Corbyn as their leader, which I'd say seems almost counterproductive politically, because you would expect them to maybe choose a Remainer, right? To contrast the parallels between Theresa May and the Conservatives, and then the 48% that wanted to stay. But they assigned Jeremy Corbyn as their leader. So why did they do that in the first place?
Austerity, disaffection, and a distrust of New Labour. Why are we supporting Bernie? Why is AOC popular right now? This is the resurgent left. And Jeremy Corbyn made a lot of people excited for very similar reasons why a lot of people are excited to see the return of a kind of overtly progressive politics in this country. the health, the cuts to health care, the cuts to the welfare state, and an anger that the Labour Party, this is particularly under Tony Blair, but then Tony Blair's, oh my God, what, my brain just completely, the Scottish guy. Anyway, that new Labour had lost hold of its roots, gotten too business friendly, and was not actually representing the will of the vast majority of its base. And so now the Labour brass did not want Jeremy Corbyn. But again, enough of the membership sort of pushed him into the space. Now, had Labour had a different leader, we might be in a very different position right now. But it is, in a way, a perfect storm with the leadership of both the major parties ultimately being very polarizing to the membership, to MPs, and so there's dissent breaking out all over the place.
Right, so the British Parliament is in pretty much chaos.
It is, I mean.
So why did the European Union choose to give them that extension? Why not just punish the Brits for not being, for being stubborn, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think France is certainly moving to more of that stance. You know, it doesn't look good to have a member leave. And ultimately, and it's certainly with a hard Brexit, I mean, it's disastrous for Britain, but it won't be good for the EU either. You know, it'll also suffer from having to, out of nowhere, have to create a whole set of new, legislation, apparatus, infrastructure to deal with this breakup if it's a hardcore breakup. So it's not in the EU's interest to have a no deal. But the EU could absorb it more easily than the Brexit. So ultimately, no deal is still very much a possibility. I think that in a way, this whole process and how hard Brexit has been is a kind of powerful deterrent to other countries who might be thinking about. And also, I mean, the other country that often makes a lot of noise about this is Italy. But Italy is an even tougher position because they are members. They have the euro. They you know, Britain kept its own currency. Yeah. And if you're also integrated to the level of the euro, that adds a whole other level of problems if you want to opt out. But ultimately, I think that the EU membership, they're sort of flummoxed and flabbergasted and bewildered by Britain's complete inability to kind of decide what it wants. And I think that's it, because Brexit, you know, Theresa May would always say Brexit means Brexit, but
what is Brexit?
What is Brexit?
Brexit means what you want it to mean. and actually, when the hard realities of what a breakup with the EU are actually tabulated, people actually see the numbers and what it actually looks like, there's a backing away from that position. And again, what's interesting about the polls is Remain has certainly gained. Now, it's not up to levels like 60% what we do see is now support for Remain has definitely gone up. And it's actually gone up in the last, 6 months as the British public is just watching this chaos unfold, complete lack of party discipline. And again, there's no consensus as to what Brexit should be, and there still isn't. And again, we are still going to have to wait and see what happens. But there could be some interesting political shakeups, and there is this, within this breathing space, there might be some new roads that are going to open up. But I'm not entirely sure what those are going to be.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Professor. I think just to wrap us up, this will be maybe our last question. So I guess our thought is, let's say everything goes to plan and somehow a deal is reached and they leave in October. What do you think a post-Brexit Europe looks like? How has Europe's influence on the world changed? How big of a deal is this going to be?
And I think this is, again, and this is my belief, but the European Union will remain a very strong player, and I think Britain will recede in importance if this happens. Now, there are problems within the European Union, again, with the rise of autocratic governments in Hungary, Poland, and so we might have a future when parts of the Eastern Bloc of the European Union might break up or break off. Italy is always threatening too. So yeah, the European Union could be weakened, but honestly, I think that the alliance that the EU has, if even it holds in its most affluent countries, which is Germany, the Netherlands, and France, and Belgium, the Benelux areas, I think even if that bloc holds, it will still be an incredibly important component of global power. The European Union is one of the sort of balancing consortiums between China, the United States, and also the growing affluence of places like India. And the European Union, I don't foresee it going away anytime soon. Now, there were certain Brexiteers who thought, like, our leaving will trigger this domino effect and everyone will leave, and they've certainly not seen that. In fact, what they have seen is, again, a kind of rising support for the European Union within the countries that benefit from it most.
Well, great, Professor. We really do appreciate you coming today. I think we had a really cool discussion, and I know I learned a lot, so that's always great. I guess to wrap us out, I have to always mention our social media, so make sure to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Hopkins POFA. Hopefully you enjoyed this lovely podcast, and tune in for next time when we discuss California's exit from the United States.
Thank you very much, Professor.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.